Before the end of April, another piece of wonderful news reached the North, terrible news for the Confederacy. On April 25th, the Union flotilla under David Glasgow Farragut captured the city of New Orleans. At 160,000 citizens, this was by far the largest city in the Confederacy, the most important port, and in terms of its symbolic value, an enormously consequential place. 3 days after Farragut had had his success, Benjamin F. Butler's Union Army occupied the city. The Federals controlled New Orleans. They would control it for the rest of the war. The South's largest city, the South's largest port, the gateway to the Mississippi Valley, is gone for the Confederacy. In late May, forces under Halleck captured Corinth and placed a Union army in position to move deeper into the Confederate hinterlands. And early in June, another Union naval force won a battle outside Memphis, and control of that important river city passed to the Union. So the North continues its unbroken string of successes in the West with the capture of these three important cities, New Orleans and Corinth, and finally Memphis. So what had this 5 months of campaigning in the West really done in terms of altering the landscape of the war? Let's look at that briefly. First, the North had gained control of both the upper and the lower reaches of the Mississippi River. It controlled the Mississippi all the way to Memphis, and it controlled New Orleans. The river is no longer a viable waterway for the Confederacy in terms of moving goods out to be shipped abroad or in terms of moving goods internally. The river is on its way to becoming a Union river. The Anaconda Plan is well underway, upper and northern parts of the river held by the North. A number of very important southern cities are in Union hands. We've already talked about all of them, but just to tick them off again, New Orleans, just finished talking about that. Corinth, Memphis, Nashville again. Do not overlook the importance of Nashville and all the things that it offered, potentially offered, to the Confederacy. As a group, these cities constituted major ports, communication centers, supply centers, industrial centers, and psychological points of great value to the Confederacy. They are all gone. Huge parts of Tennessee in Union hands are a logistical area of great bounty. The Confederate losses in Tennessee in early 1862 represent the single greatest logistical disaster that the Confederacy suffered in the entire war. There would be other very bad ones, as Sherman struck across Georgia, as Philip Sheridan cleaned out part of the Shenandoah Valley in 1864. Those hurt the logistical capacity of the Confederacy as well, but none was as great a blow as the loss of these big pieces of Middle Tennessee and West Tennessee in early 1862. And of course, we have a major Union army poised at Corinth for the next phase of whatever the North decided to do. It seemed that an enormous section of the Confederacy was vulnerable now to penetration by this Union army, and no one knew where Halleck might strike next. All the Confederacy knew is that there had been no good news, absolutely no good news from the Western theater in this entire five-month period, and they had lost the one man most of them had looked to as the principal rallying point in the Western theater. Albert Sidney Johnston was dead. P.G.T. Beauregard had removed himself from command on account of illness, he said, during the Corinth operations, and permanently alienated himself from Jefferson Davis by doing so. He did so without permission to do it. So the second most famous officer in the West was gone too. So not only had there been disaster for the Confederates in the West, but there seemed no one in place to turn this tide around. We'll leave Halleck and Grant now as the victors in the Western theater, poised to do more. They and all of their soldiers in Corinth, because great events were also taking place in the East during this same period, where George B. McClellan was first building an army and then advancing against Richmond with that army. And in our next lecture, we'll see if Little Mac, as McClellan was called, both by his soldiers and by the people behind the lines, we'll see if Little Mac could match the success of his subordinates in the Western theater.